I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks. Today, I am delighted to have Greg Iles here with me in studio. He's doing a little experiment with radio with me. Greg is a New York Times bestselling author who has just published the third and final volume in his Natchez Burning trilogy. No less than Stephen King called the first book in the series, quote, fiendishly suspenseful. And who knows fiendish better than Stephen King? Another reviewer wrote of Greg's work that it's William Faulkner for the Breaking Bad generation. Greg's new book is Mississippi Blood, and it lives up to its title, both in terms of violence, of which there is plenty, and in terms of familial blood and the secrets that haunt so many across the South. Civil rights, racial injustice, the sins of our fathers and mothers, and much more can all be found in these books. Greg Iles, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks, Eric. Glad to be here.
Well, before we get into the book and some other things, I should mention that he did not come just to see our palatial studios, although that is a reward for you. He's going to be at the Barnes & Noble at the Arboretum tonight, signing books at 7 o'clock. You can find more information on that at our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. So, welcome to Charlotte. Have you been here before, by the way?
Have not been here before.
Your debut. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Mississippi Blood. Your main character in these books is a guy named Penn Cage. He's a former prosecutor who has returned home. He's become both a popular novelist and he's the mayor of Natchez, Mississippi, which is also your hometown. Tell me a little bit about when this character began to form in your mind and what you think has kept him interesting for you through now six books.
Well, you know, when I initially wrote Penn Cage, it was back in 1988 in a novel called The Quiet Game that was meant to be a standalone. Never intended to write a series. I love reading series, but to me, writing a series would be just suicidally boring. I never meant to do that. So I waited 7 years before I did the second Penn Cage book, another seven for the third. But as I began to write more about the Deep South, I'm from Mississippi, of course, and my hometown and these conflicts, Penn was sort of the natural observer for those stories. And so I went back to him. The good thing and what's kept it interesting is he began as sort of a Grisham-esque Boy Scout thriller. And I say that's no cut against John. He's a good friend.
He's done all right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And Penn has evolved because he's in the way that he's had to compromise his principles in order to fight against the antagonist or evil. And now he's certainly a much more complex character.
Now, when you started on this trilogy, you had written several Penn Cage novels before, but you were nearly killed in a car wreck in 2011. At the time, you had started Natchez Burning, or you had started, I'm sorry, I guess Mississippi Blood at that
yeah,
point?
Yeah, Natchez Burning.
Natchez Burning, yeah. Right. I had it right the first time. That's rare. Tell me a little bit about how the wreck, you lost a leg in that wreck. You were in a medically induced coma. Yeah. How did that not just affect your work, but how did that change your life?
Well, it's ironic. At the time that happened, my previous book had been number one in the country, and I was about 51 years old. So I was at that point in your life you might think you never even get to. You've achieved your dreams to a degree. And I was trying to write Natchez Burning as one book. I knew it wasn't working, and with a week left, I pulled out on Highway 61. Truck hit my driver's door going 70. Didn't just take the leg off. Tore the aorta, shattered my pelvis, my legs, my ribs, many, many bones. And so when I came out of that coma, everything looked different. And the decision I made was, hey, if it takes more books to tell this story, I'm not going to worry about the commercial exigencies. Let's just let the chips fall. Now, what happened? I lost my agent. I lost my publisher. I was 5 years off the shelf. Now, that's from a guy who'd been number one a year before, okay? So it's been a journey, and nobody knew how it would what would happen. But the books ended up resonating, and, you know, it was the right thing to do. I'm now perceived as a completely different kind of writer. That was never my intent, but that's what happened.
You know? So your agent and your publisher dumped you while you were recovering from a near-fatal car wreck?
Well, in this show, we have time for subtleties. My agent really didn't necessarily agree with what I was doing, so I changed agents. And then in defense of my publisher, let's face it, you write about sports business. Publishing's a business, right? These guys had paid me a massive advance 2 years before. Now, so they've been waiting 2 years, and I come along and say, oh, I'm not going to give you a thriller you can put out for Gulf Shores Vacation. I'm going to give you 2,300 pages to change the world. That does not resonate well in the boardroom. So ultimately, they made a tough decision for them, and in a single day, I went from feeling wealthy to owing them every penny they'd paid me in advance. So it was a pretty insane state of affairs.
How do you think obviously, you went from, you know, your traditional thriller to this sprawling trilogy that you've just completed. But how did it change your writing, if at all?
It changed the writing and what I was willing to do and where I was willing to go. You know, I write the kind of books that some people say you have to wait for certain people to die before you can even write the book. You know what I mean? You got to be cautious about being sued. You got to be cautious about hurt feelings. But again, after the accident, I just had to not care. I just said there's nothing I'm not going to look at, and particularly when I presented the racial violence, which are based on real murders near my hometown that were unsolved, I could not worry who might get angry, who might get upset, and that's the real difference.
Now, I want to read you your own work, which probably doesn't happen very often, but I want to read this from Mississippi Blood, and this is a description. A lot of the book takes place in a courtroom in Natchez, Mississippi. And here's how you describe the courtroom. It's an African-American judge who is presiding. You say, quote, "Above the judge's bench hangs the state seal, but the most iconic and ironic artifact in the courtroom is the Mississippi state flag, which, despite hanging in the court of an African-American judge, still bears the Confederate battle flag in its upper left quadrant." That is interesting for several reasons, one of which, of course, is you have worked to remove that Confederate flag, and you're in a part of the country where only 2 years ago the Confederate flag was finally removed from the state capitol in South Carolina. So I'm wondering what your perspective is on the resonance of the Confederate flag.
Well, I've had to deal with that in a lot of ways, Eric. But as you say, last year, about the most meaningful thing that I've done to engage with that is myself and John Grisham organized the writers and artists of Mississippi around the time South Carolina took it down. We organized the artists, writers, some athletes and coaches in Mississippi, everybody from Morgan Freeman and Jimmy Buffett to Hugh Freeze and Dan Mullen, Archie Manning. Talk about that's Mississippi royalty right there. All the writers. But we're still fighting that battle. You know, we just wanted people out in the country to know, hey, there's some sanity in Mississippi still. But in my hometown, it's still used as a symbol often of the old South related to tourism. Everything's in a state of change. Mississippi has a particularly, the kind word I will use is stubborn legislature. They seem intent on shooting themselves in the foot in at every opportunity.
Some would say you're not alone in having that stubborn legislation.
I suspect that, yeah.
but these books, again, are so much about race and the struggle, not just in the South, but in America. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from people as you begin to make your way around the country.
Here's the irony. When I began Natchez Burning, people were actually had begun talking about America as a post-racial society. That seems quaint, funny, and tragic now. I don't think one person in America would now argue we live in a post-racial society, right? At home, you know, people from the South realize this, that the South has always been the whipping boy for the nation on race. Isn't that racism terrible down there in the South? And what I hope these books have helped to do is dispel that myth. Because if the events of the last 2 or 3 years have proved anything, it's that racism is not a sectional Southern problem. It's an American problem, a national problem. These police shootings and the protests and everything, they're not happening in Selma or Natchez, Mississippi. They're happening all out in the North, the West. So the country's changing, and I'm afraid we live to see some interesting times. They're coming.
Yeah, you mentioned you've spent most of your life in Mississippi. I grew up in Louisiana. I'm in North Carolina now, so I've my whole life a Southerner. And you're right. The issue of race seems as difficult and thorny as it's ever been, even after 2 terms of having our first African-American president. I'm wondering if you were like a lot of us, did you think, maybe not that we were going to be a post-racial society, but that in 2008, did you have some hope that maybe some of those barriers had been cleared?
Yes, I think what white America did is just, and I'm just speaking as a realist, not as a liberal or a conservative, with the civil rights legislation of the mid-60s, and then our sort of wrong-headed legislation of the Great Society to thinking we could magically fix the poverty gap and the gap in capital, we all sort of went on autopilot for a while thinking, well, enough's been done. And the election of President Obama really let you go to sleep and say, okay, it may not be perfect, but it's all going to work out. And then suddenly we realize, oh, no, there's a massive chasm between the two races in perception and in the reality of living. And that's what we got to address somehow.
Now, obviously, you're a writer of popular fiction. This is a commercial enterprise. So you're not in the business of serving up heaping plates of spinach. But while people are being entertained by Mississippi Blood and these other books, what are you hoping that maybe they take away from it?
Well, here's what I do. You put it well there. What I do, if I had written a nonfiction book about these murders that happened by my house, and I went on preaching about race, nobody would listen. Nobody would read it, right? What I do is seduce the reader in with something they can't turn away from. As one reviewer said, imagine Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus no son should ever know about his father. You pull people in, and maybe suddenly on page 300 or 400, they start to think, huh, that happened right near where I live, or something like that happened in the town I grew up. And they start to see it from the other side. And if I can make people do that, that's all I can hope to do.
And part of what made you see it from the other side is that your father was a doctor, and he treated African-American patients for many, many years, correct?
That's right. My dad was one of those docs that every town has them, you know, the old gray-bearded doc who will accept payment in a bucket of catfish or mustard greens. I am not kidding. And more than half his patients were black, and he didn't see race. He'd been an Army doc. He just grew up a little different, even though he grew up in DeRidder, Louisiana, not that far from you. And he really shaped me, and so he's alive in the pages of these books, even though he's gone.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, these books, one of the big plot elements is Penn Cage, your protagonist, is trying to prevent his father from going to prison, and not just prison, Parchman. For anyone in the South, they know that's, you know, as bad and stark as it gets. And I was wondering how much of your father is in the character Dr. Tom Cage.
A lot. And I will say, Tom's sins are not my father's exact sins, but the things that Tom are suspected of, I mean, as you know, he had an affair with his African-American nurse in the 60s. He may or may not have a child who's the brother of the protagonist. I mean, that gets into the essence of where the white and black races secretly meet in the South. It's not something talked about, but it's gone on from the beginning. And, you know, my father knew a lot about that, let's say.
So you mentioned you've written 2,300 pages, you know, which is just unbelievable. And for anyone out there who's saying, my God, how do you write it or how would you read it? Trust me, I've read all three. It's much easier to read them than to write them. I'm convinced of that. But after you do something like that and you're out promoting the book and talking about it, how do you even begin to think about writing something new at some point?
Well, I'm already writing something new that's actually set at Ole Miss in Oxford, Mississippi. Here's the quandary.
Hotty totty.
Yeah. Here's the quandary. When the reaction to this book happened and suddenly people are saying, oh, you're the next Pat Conroy or something like that, you start to wonder, well, is it okay to just go back to a lighter sort of film noir kind of thriller or something? Or are people going to say, oh, you sold out, or, well, he was just a flash in the pan. We thought he was something, but he's just like James Patterson or whatever, you know?
And so which direction are you going in?
Little bit lighter, a lot shorter, Eric.
I knew you were a sellout when you walked. No,
800 pages per volume, man. That's a little heavy.
And will you stay with these characters, or are you going in a different direction?
There's one more to come, I think, with these characters, but it won't be the next book or the next.
All right, there you go. We'll leave you with a little cliffhanger. We're speaking with Greg Iles here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We'll be back in just a minute to check out his music career.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Pink Martini vocalist Storm Large performs songs like Got You Under My Skin and Lady is a Tramp from the Great American Songbook, Friday and Saturday at Knight Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. After years of declining homicide rates, the numbers are rising here and around the country. Charlotte has experienced two consecutive years of climbing rates, and the numbers are up sharply this year so far, with 21 homicides in the first 3 months of 2017. Why is this happening, and what can be done to reverse it? The CDC has called this a public health crisis. We talk to them, as well as local police and medical professionals, when Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9. More of our conversation with Greg Iles coming up in a moment here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, hundreds arrested in anti-corruption protests in Russia, including Putin opposition leader Alexei Navalny. We'll look at this latest crackdown in Russia. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join that conversation on Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
We're back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are talking with Greg Iles, who is the author of Mississippi Blood, which is part of his Natchez Burning trilogy, about 2,300 pages. And you mentioned during the break that you don't want people to think that they're not going to get some answers with this final book, right?
Yeah, a lot of people have been invested from the first page of Natchez Burning, and I want them to know at least the answers you want. Who killed Viola? Is Tom guilty or innocent? You're going to find that stuff out when you go to bed, before you go to bed and turn the last page.
So he will. He will deliver. And I finished the book last night because I was doing my cramming in the library, so to speak, and you answered the questions, but I'm not going to give any of the answers away. I wanted to mention, you've had, I think, something like 14 bestsellers in your career.
Yeah.
Is that right?
14 or 15, yeah.
Started with your debut in 1993. Now, when that first book came out, Amazon did not exist.
Oh.
People didn't read books on iPhones because iPhones didn't exist. And I'm wondering, what is the commercial side of being a novelist like in 2017 versus 1993?
A lot of guys and women who were there when I started who were big time, I hadn't heard their name in 10 years. That's one thing. Second, for beginning writers, back when I sold Spandau Phoenix, there were about 35 independent publishers who could bid on your book. Now you got 3-4 multinationals determine everything and Amazon. So the corporatization of it all has changed. Second, the consumption. You went from a broad-based independent selling industry to the superstores, which nearly killed them, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. Now Barnes & Noble fighting for its life against Amazon, and Borders gone.
Mm-hmm.
Books a Million consumes some of the old Borders. So it's an industry in total flux, and nobody knows who's going to survive or how it will look on the other end. As a writer, all you can do is do your best to ignore it. A lot of beginners are going into the self-published space. That used to be a sort of joke. Now it's not so much a joke. I know guys who make a good living selling self-published stuff on Amazon, but I'd still recommend going the mainstream way if you get the opportunity.
Now, you mentioned Barnes & Noble. Of course, you will save Barnes & Noble at the Arboretum single-handedly tonight. You'll be there at 7 o'clock. So just a reminder, if you go to the website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks, you can find out how to spend a little time with Greg and help him save the literary world. From a commercial perspective, how important – I know adaptations have always been important, but how much more important is that now given the other financial pressures in the industry?
Adaptations in turn – you mean –
TV, movies.
Yeah, well, if you get it, it's great. It's that's always for me. I tell you what, they made a movie of one of my early books. I made a lot of money off that, but it scared me away from Hollywood for about 10 years. You know, John Grisham once gave me the best advice on film any writer ever did. He said, Greg, here's what you do when they want your book. You drive to the California border, book in hand. You very reluctantly pass it over the state line, snatch the check, cash the check, drive back to Mississippi and never think about it again. And that was the best advice I ever got. Now,
that's a guy who's had Tom Cruise and Matt Damon and everybody. He still says, just run.
That is a writer, which in L.A. is the lowest form of life, who has had actual cast approval over his movies, okay? And he's still saying, leave it alone. But it's an important component.
Every author, we're talking about the book business, every author knows about remainders. Those are the books that are unsold. They're returned by the bookstores to the publishers. But not everybody knows about the Rock Bottom Remainders, which is the name of a literary band that you play in with some guy named Stephen King, another guy named Dave Barry. Mitch Albom, Amy Tan. All these no-name authors,
yeah.
But you were actually
losers.
Just total losers. Scott Turow.
But overrated.
Overrated. You were in a band before you became a writer.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, help us break down the musical chops of the Rock Bottom Remainders.
First of all, anybody who's ignorant of the Remainders lives in blissful ignorance, number one, unless they're very drunk, which Dave Barry recommends. Dave Barry's the band leader. Alcohol mandatory. As Dave says, we play music as well as Metallica writes novels.
Oh, I like that. Now that guy's got a future.
That Dave is a master of setting low expectations. See, if you set it that low, a few of us, Mitch Albom, myself, Ridley Pearson, were musicians, pros, before we did it. And then Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, another overrated loser there. He plays with us quite a bit. So what we tend to do is have a chaotic oldies rock set, which is about what you expect. But really, for about 20 minutes in the middle, we rock it pretty good.
Oh, really? Yeah. All right.
So it can be fun. It's sort of a schizophrenic show. But I'll tell you this. There is no experience on earth that beats playing Don't Fear the Reaper on stage with Stephen King singing lead and yelling more cowbell. Okay.
So about how many gigs a year are we getting out of the Rock Bottom Remainders these days?
Well, you got to figure the combined total incomes of the Remainders is pretty high.
Yeah.
So to get them on a bus or a plane is tough. Now, on a serious note, our founder died a few years ago, and we said we were going to retire. But like many sports retirements, or as Dave says, we didn't retire. So we got a gig coming up in Sun Valley in July. So they're limited, but we're still playing.
Very good. And for you, having been a musician, you know, you were trying to go the pop music route before you became a novelist. Any chance you would trade writing for music?
Yeah, all of us would.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? If they pay me what they pay me to write books, no, if they paid me a third of what they pay me to write books to be a rock star, I'd throw it all away tomorrow, and so would almost every member of that band.
Well, I think the Edge might have a sore thumb, so we'll call Bono. We'll get that set up.
Hey.
Have you written about music in terms of beyond Penn Cage, or would you like to?
I'd like to. One thing I did was we did a book. The Remainders did a book. And one thing they asked us to do, they had this computer that can tell writing styles by artificial intelligence. And they had a contest who could write the closest to Stephen King. Me, Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, and maybe one other. We had this contest. And that was a musical-based story there. And that was so fun. But in general, that's not what people are going to pay me to write. You
know? By the way, what is the key? What are the verbal tics of a Stephen King impersonation?
You tend to have some name brands in there.
Oh yeah,
you tend to cross the line into the graphic of violence.
But that's not hard for you to do. I just finished Mississippi Blood.
But people underrate Steve terribly. You know, people forget that great movies like Shawshank Redemption and Stand By Me were written by Stephen King as novellas, and they are as fine as anything anybody ever did. So at his core, Steve is just a genius. To think of him as just a horror writer is very limiting. You know?
Yeah, I agree. He's one of my favorites. You mentioned earlier that you went to school, obviously, at Ole Miss, and you studied under the late Willie Morris, who, for people unfamiliar with Willie Morris, he's one of the late Willie Morris, beloved literary sons of Mississippi. He was the youngest publisher of Harper's Magazine. He wrote a famous memoir, New York Days. And when he was at Ole Miss, as I recall, he would bring in a lot of his buddies, James Dickey, who wrote Deliverance, and sort of William Styron, who wrote Sophie's Choice.
Who's a lot more familiar in this area.
Absolutely. So I'm wondering, what was that like for you as a student to be around all these big name accomplished writers?
I'll tell you what that did, and not just for me, but some other very successful writers. It isn't that Willie or any of those guys taught us how to write, but we grew up in a state where the last guy who got paid to write books was William Faulkner. You don't look at that as a kid and go, hey, that's what I'm doing, okay?
Nobel? Sure.
No, right. So Willie brings in these guys like Dickey. I got to watch James Dickey introduce Deliverance in a little theater before we went and got drunk in the bar. Now, once you've done that for a while, here's what happens. You realize, hey, maybe you can do this for a living. And I wasn't the only one in that program. In a 3 or 4 or 5 year span, Grisham, me, Donna Tartt, who since won the Pulitzer, and several others. And I think all of those were Mississippi kids who saw, at least, thanks to Willie, hey, this is a viable way to live your life, you know?
Now, you obviously have Mississippi running through you through and through. As you go around the country, you know, Mississippi, much like my home state of Louisiana, it's one of those places that people just see as different, a little bit alien. I'm wondering, you know, What kind of myths do you have to knock down when you go around the country and people start asking you about Mississippi?
A lot of myths, okay? Here's the deal. When I'm in Mississippi, I'm one of its most vocal critics. If I'm in New York and somebody's bad-mouthing Mississippi, I might just punch them in the face. It's like your family, okay? Only you get to talk about your brother or your mother. And I'll quote Morgan Freeman about Mississippi. A reporter famously said, "Mr. Freeman, obviously you could live anywhere in the world that you want to. When you're not making movies, why do you live in Mississippi?" And Morgan looked down for a minute and he said, "Because I can live anywhere I want to." That
good
says
answer.
It all right there.
Good answer. So you may have answered my next question, which is you go through this writing program with Willie Morris. You go off to take on U2 and the gang, and then you decide to be a writer. And you wound up moving back to Natchez. What made you – what called you home?
That's hard to answer. My wife at the time had just got out of dental school. Her father was a dentist. My dad was still alive. He was a doctor. And just that's sort of what you do in Mississippi, Louisiana, too. You know that. People still get married at 22, 23, head home and start becoming their parents like a week after they get out of college. I don't understand it to this day.
So did you become your parents?
No, I did not. Well, I hope I got close to them a little bit, but not a complete imitation.
You, much of the inspiration for these books, the trilogy that we're talking about, Natchez Burning, it comes from actual events. And some of the events and some of the racial killings that you talk about were actually reported by a man named Stanley Nelson at the Concordia Sentinel in Louisiana, which is like a 4,700 circulation paper nominated for a Pulitzer. I'm wondering how you began to pay attention to his work and also what he thinks of your fictionalized version of some of his reporting.
Well, that's the best question. I'm glad you asked it, Eric. Stanley, I didn't know Stanley originally. As I began to write Natchez Burning as a family-centered story, I discovered these murders I hadn't even known about, that Stanley was working these cold cases. And this is a guy who, making no money, as you know, in 8 years, accomplished more than the FBI did in 40 years. And to me, this was a guy, he wasn't investigating the murder of Medgar Evers or Martin Luther King. He was investigating the murders of just regular black folks in his hometown. Nobody was going to thank him for it, but he did it because it was something that needed doing. And he is Stanley. He wouldn't want me to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. This guy finally, last week, the people who made the movie Spotlight about the exposing the Catholic Church, they won the Pulitzer, beat Stanley when he was a finalist. Those people have finally come knocking on his door to tell his story for Hollywood and stuff. And he also has a book out this week, Devil's Walking. I'm glad to see that. Now, Stanley and I share experience, and that is, some people are glad at what we've done. Other people take that attitude, which you hear in every southern state. Why are you dragging that old stuff up? You're just making it worse, you know? But the answer to that is always simple, and that is, okay, if it was your mother, your father, your brother that somebody killed and nobody ever lifted a finger, you'd have a different feeling about it. If that's really the end of the discussion.
Well, and sunlight is the best disinfectant, right?
Yes.
And it is a whether it directly involved you or your family, it envelops all of us.
Yes.
That's what these novels are about.
Yeah, and that's part of without getting political, that's part of what we face today is on one side of the equation, there's this formless, shapeless, but very real hurt, resentment, anger about all those unreported, unacknowledged, terrible things that happened. And boy, there were a lot. And a lot of them happened right next to you. I mean, a lot of white people grew up in ignorance because the way things worked. I mean, 1 mile from my house, the biggest KKK meeting that ever happened in America happened 1 mile from my house when I was 5 years old. And I wouldn't even know, except my father dragged me down the street to see it, the way he did when we were in Germany and he dragged me down the street to see Eisenhower ride by, okay? What I remember is not just the men, the women, and the kids in the robes, but, man, the horses in the robes. And you talk about scary, freaky thing. But again, half the people in the city didn't even know that was going on. So you have this schizophrenic state in the South. But I go back to this. It isn't just the South. In the South, racism is overt, and it's not hypocritical. In the North, it is covert and hypocritical. And that has been noted by black leaders like Charles Evers, James Brown, the singer, who said notably, look, I feel better dealing with a Southerner who may resent me and hate me, but I know he's telling me the truth and he's going to do what he says he's going to do. I've been in Washington and had a Yankee smile in my face, stab me in the back 10 seconds.
Well, as you're saying that, I'm thinking of the famous Martin Luther King quote when he went up to Chicago and was dealing with housing. And he said, those people up there could teach Mississippi something about hate.
There you go.
And as you're talking about these years of history, just yesterday, Charlotte had been going through a lengthy study of economic inequality, lack of mobility, and one of the co-chairs, an African-American doctor here, said, look, we're trying to clear up 400 years of history. It's not going to happen in just a couple of years, and it sounds like you would probably agree with her sentiment.
I would, and look, I understand the white side. People get angry when they hear that. They get very angry and feel like African Americans are not justified in saying any of that. When are you going to put that behind you? When are you going to forget about it? When are you going to say we've done enough? The thing is, the depths of those things, the disparities between things like preservation of capital on the white side, things we've had in our families going back generations that have never even existed on the black side. You don't get so angry about something unless you know you're wrong to a degree, okay? And on the white side, what is our treasured myth? My people came from nothing, and they worked hard. My daddy made me this and whatever. Nobody on the white side wants to admit I was born on third base, at least relative to the guy down the street who lived in the hollow. That's a hard thing to do. I don't know when and how we're going to get to that place of agreement. I don't know.
How much pushback do you get? I'm curious when you're out, you know, most of the people that show up at your signings probably enjoy your work. That's why they're there. But do you get much pushback in terms of the themes and the elements in these books?
Not frequently. What I'll get is like at Malaprops, two or three people will be walking by who aren't even readers of mine, but they'll hear me talking. They'll walk in and suddenly you get a pretty spirited discussion from one side or the other. But I think in a way, people are relieved. Most people are relieved. It's like, hey, let's just get it out there, man. It doesn't do any good to just pretend. That's not advancing anybody. So,
does it make you feel any better to have gotten it out there in terms of getting it on the page that you've been able to say this?
I don't kid myself that I've necessarily accomplished much. And does it make me feel better? Look, my job as an artist was just to try to deal with it in the context of that short little story I wrote, 2,300 pages. That's all I can handle. And
that little novella you put together.
Whew, yeah. It's time for me to think about less heavy things.
You know? Yeah, you mentioned that you're going to go a little bit lighter next time. So will you stay, you think, in a similar genre? Or
I think I'll stay in the South. Okay. I won't abandon the South, even though I have a lot. I've been lucky. I'm one of those few writers who has. I've written about World War II. I've written about artificial intelligence. I've set thrillers that have to do with repressed memories of child abuse. And most readers out there know this. Most writers simply rewrite the last book. That's what publishers want you to do. You start that income stream for them, writing a thriller about ex-Secret Service, you know, Tom Swift or whatever. They want 20 more of those. And that's what the guy who's going on a cruise or going to Gulf Shores wants. But the sad thing is, so too often, the quality of those kind of books goes down rapidly. They're three or four good ones, and then they slide into just repetition. And I've been lucky not to have to do that, and I never want to do that. That's my main thing.
On that note, we're going to take a little break. We're speaking with Greg Iles. He is the author of Mississippi Blood, and you are listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE, and I am Eric Spanberg.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Firebird Arts Alliance, presenting Bach's St. John Passion, a musical retelling of Christ's last days and his strength in facing persecution, a semi-stage show this Saturday and concert Sunday. Tickets at foxfirebird.org. Hundreds have been arrested in anti-corruption protests in Russia. Among those rounded up, an opposition leader to President Vladimir Putin. Coming up in 20 minutes on Point with Tom Ashbrook, a look at this latest crackdown. If you'd like to join our conversation with author Greg Iles, now's your chance. You can email charlottetalks at wfae.org, reach us through Facebook at WFAE, or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. More of our conversation in a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The man known as the Dutch Donald Trump was dealt a sharp defeat in elections yesterday in the Netherlands.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
A clean repeal of House Bill 2 seems out of reach. Republican lawmakers have made that clear. But the governor...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
We're back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're talking to Greg Iles about the third book in his Natchez Burning trilogy. It is called Mississippi Blood. And I wanted to ask you something. You mentioned Pat Conroy earlier, of course, beloved in the Carolinas everywhere, but especially in the Carolinas because this was his home turf. And we lost Pat Conroy too soon. But I interviewed you by phone a couple of years ago, and you had just met Pat Conroy, and you called it a bucket list moment. So I'm wondering, there are so many Pat Conroy fans in Charlotte and Carolinas, if you could just share a little bit what that was like.
All right, I'm going to tell you two things, and one, I'm going to have to issue my own bleep, okay?
Okay.
I was signing in Savannah. I didn't even know Pat was going to be at this place. I'd never met him. And I found out his line, signing line, was opposite this me on this little park. And we both had really long lines. And one of the organizers came over to me and said, would you like to meet Pat Conroy? And I said, well, hell yeah, absolutely, you know, come on. And so she goes, all right, he's finishing up his line. I'll take you over there in a second. So she takes me over there, and it's typical book signing moment. What is there? There's a lady, the last person in the line with like three kids, and I see Pat with glazed look in his eyes. She's going, and then Judy had number six, and then and I'm just going, oh, my God, okay. So I waited, and then she went away, and I said, Pat, look, I know you don't know who I am. And he looked up at me and said, are you the famous Greg Iles? And I was like, oh, my God. So I sat down. We talked about mutual friends like Roy Blunt Jr., Willie, and people. And he told me some things on that day. Now, I never got to know him well, and I didn't know he was ill. But I will say, shortly after that, I got involved in changing an 80-year-old community pageant in Natchez. It runs for 4 years, called the Confederate Pageant and the Natchez Pilgrimage. And I had to rewrite it to include Black history. And I had to do that. I had to deal with and fight with two garden clubs, which if anybody knows what that is, I'd rather fight a land war in Asia than fight with two garden clubs. Okay. Now, in the middle of one night, I'm down there directing and working with an African-American choir. And on the left, I got a bunch of Confederate soldiers and a Confederate flag, which gives you some idea. My phone rings and it says South Carolina. I have no idea who that is, but I answer. And it's Conroy, and he's had a few drinks. And so I go outside, and he's telling me he knows what I'm doing from my emails. And he said, that's what you're doing? I said, Greg, I told my wife if I'm ever fool enough to get involved in something like that, shoot my blank off. And at least I went back in there, and at least, you know, he lightened up that night for me. He was a character, man.
So you were single-handedly navigating the modern-day Civil War. How did that wind up for you?
My daughter got a documentary film out of it. We changed the world for about 2 years, but I got to say, I don't think they were quite ready. Garden clubs, even though there are some fine ladies in there and some forward-thinking ones, they are not the ideal organizations to bring a fair and balanced presentation of history.
These are not the agents of change.
They were steeped in the lost cause, let's say that.
Okay. And in terms of Conroy, though, you mentioned, you know, your style obviously evolved after the car wreck, and you were thinking of people like him as you shifted into this new focus. What about his work inspired you?
I think Pat certainly, like James Lee Burke, devotes a lot more effort to the actual art of writing when it comes to description, rich language, and those kind of things. So we don't have that in common. I have some passages where I do that, but what he did was, this is what I came to. Pat wrote about, most of his books had to do or sprang from having a father who he wasn't sure loved him. My books spring from having a father who loved me and who was beloved, not just by his family, but by his community. But yet maybe at his core, he wasn't the person we all thought he was. So we were both writing sort of in relation to our fathers, but in a different way. That's how we related, I think.
Going back to your musical sideline, you know, all kidding aside, you've got a pretty notable all-star roster of writers there. How much do you talk shop, or is it the kind of thing where you just want to avoid talking shop at all costs?
Well, Dave has a rule that we cannot talk about riding on the bus or the plane, but we break it all the time. You know, Scott Turow and I'll be in the back. Dave says we got to keep it to the level of booger jokes. You know, that's the therapy right there. It's hard to describe, but I will say this in all seriousness. When you're a best-selling author, you're in a pretty lucky position, and not many people sympathize with the problems of best-selling writers. But you do have them, certainly. So there is nothing – and writing's a very isolating job because not many people have it. You're not surrounded by writers. So when you get to go on these tours and hang out with people who do exactly what you do, you certainly do talk shop. You talk about the industry and all that. Plus, it's just leavened by, yeah, you're playing a song by the Troggs or you're doing whatever you're doing. It is the coolest thing I ever get to do.
You mentioned, you know, writing is such a solitary occupation. Obviously, you've been out on the road for a week. You've been to 10 cities. This is kind of your own little barnstorming tour. You've been to Mississippi, Tennessee, Alabama, Kentucky, now North Carolina. So what are you hearing from people, and what do you enjoy about – I mean, obviously, you're out to promote the book and sell the book, but it's more than that. You're meeting all these people. What's it like?
The closer I get to home, like really the deep, deep South – the more a lot of people are there just because I'm from there. When I get out here, I get more what you said. People who do really read me, people who do care more about the issues, people are more educated about the issues this way. I mean, let's face it, Mississippi's 50th in everything. Think Louisiana may beat us in some things as far as being on the bottom. But so what I notice when
go
I
go to hell, Ole Miss. I'm sorry. Go.
When I get out here, or like I'm going to Michigan or I'm going to Scottsdale, really, the character of the crowds changes. The question types change. It gets a little more confrontational, but certainly more in depth. But again, everybody cares about these same things. You know, it's family. It's our lives. You know.
So for people who are listening to you today, and we're talking a lot about the race and what's gone on in the South, and you mentioned 2,300-page trilogy. People say, "My gosh, you know, I don't know. Where should they start with your work?"
Yeah. You can come to this third book by itself. I took great care to make sure people could do that. But I would go back to Natchez Burning, the first one. And you can – I've written about many different things, so I wouldn't say start anywhere. But any of the Penn Cage books, I guess the best thing to get across, since we've been talking about the length so much, is here's my rule. If a book is good or great, it can't be long enough. If it's bad, it can't be short enough. Think about a book like Lonesome Dove.
I was just about to mention Lonesome Dove.
I'd have paid $10,000 for that not to end.
Yeah.
Okay? So I want to reassure people, when you come to this, that's the kind of book this is. It ain't Lonesome Dove, but you will not feel like you're reading some heavy tome or eating through a can of spinach. This is plenty of donuts in here to keep you going long. You know?
Well, you're in Krispy Kreme territory, so you might have gotten an audience with that. Tell me a little bit about some of the research that you had to do to put these together.
I've written, like I said, a lot of different type of books. Sometimes, as with my first book, we're talking about years of research into the war and things known and unknown. But when you follow that cardinal dictum, which is write what you know, and you start writing about the place you grew up, you know where all the dirt roads go already. In some ways, you already have the tools you need. But also, you come to things like Stanley's work. You deal with experts. You talk to guys who – I mean, look, I was taken on a tour of Louisiana by stuff to do with Kennedy and Carlos Marcello and all that. I was taken on a tour of New Orleans by a cop who was a New Orleans cop who had worked for Carlos Marcello, taken graft, then was a homicide detective in Natchez, and I knew this guy had killed multiple people. And he took me on a tour of Louisiana into sheriff's offices, government offices, without a single appointment, and we weren't turned away anywhere because he knew where the bodies were buried. And being from Louisiana, you know there are a lot of bodies buried, right?
Yeah.
That kind of research, wow. You can't do any other way.
Yeah, and I should mention for listeners who are unfamiliar, Carlos Marcello is now dead. I sound like the Saturday Night Live skit, right? But he was a New Orleans mobster, and he had often been perhaps linked to Kennedy conspiracy theories, among other things, and ran New Orleans for many, many years. And there is a lot of that kind of element in these three books in particular, and it sounds like you went straight to the source to find it.
Marcella, people think of him as a mafioso. Look, he was the biggest business in the state of Louisiana in his prime, bigger than the oil business. He controlled the mafia from Dallas on the west to at least the Dixie Mafia limits in the east. I mean, you know, a lot of us grew up in a time where criminals had a lot of control over our society, and we didn't even know it or notice it, largely because of that sort of unwritten agreement whereby mobsters basically only killed each other. Street crime was kept low. They controlled a certain amount of the police, and everybody was happy because you could walk out, you could leave your house unlocked and, you know, do what you needed to do. It's funny the compromises we will make to have, you know, a placid life.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And when you have started to get into these issues, and obviously some of it is fictionalized, but I'm wondering whether you ever hear from people who may have been involved or witnessed things
I get a lot of letters from convicts, let's put it that way. And interestingly, I'm banned in some prisons. I found out there is a banned list. But if you're
that's a little different than Harry Potter at the county library.
Yeah. If you're graphic about certain things in your books, they don't want convicts, you know, getting hold of that. Now, you talk about reactions. I'm going to tell you, I can say this because the guy's dead. One of the most reprehensible characters I ever created was a judge in the first Penn Cage book, The Quiet Game. His name was Leo Marston. He was pretty closely based on a guy I knew who was a dad of a friend of mine who had risen to become a Supreme Court justice in Mississippi. And I was really worried, man, this guy's going to sue me. This could be bad. But what do I hear 2-3 weeks after the book comes out? This guy is bragging all over the South that the character is him.
See, it's like the great Santini. It's like Conroy. See,
that's right.
It all comes around. So you're covered.
That's right. There you go.
So as you're looking at your future projects, you mentioned obviously you'll do a couple more Penn Cage novels. Have you ever flirted with the idea of nonfiction because you know so many of these stories?
I have. I don't know that that's my calling, and I think what I'm headed toward, you know. Originally, there was a sort of bidding war over this project, and I've been co-producing this with the actor Tobey Maguire, with the writer of Friday Night Lights, the Texas football show, and John Lee Hancock, the director of The Blind Side. We hit a little bit of a log jam recently, and so hopefully with this book coming out, it's been number one in Barnes & Noble this week, hopefully we'll break that log jam. But in the course of producing with those guys, some opportunities have come up to write some cable television, and I may take that as a little break from what I'm doing.
So you might tip over that California state line and stay for a week or two.
Stay for 6 months and then get out.
Now, I can't miss the opportunity. He mentioned Barnes & Noble. Greg Iles is going to be at the Barnes & Noble at the Arboretum tonight at 7 o'clock, signing books, telling tales. If you need details, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Let's get back to the Tobey Maguire mention, since everybody likes Spider-Man. The series, is it still for Amazon that you're trying to put together based on Natchez?
We don't know right now. I don't want to tell too many details. Being a producer, I shouldn't tell too many details. But let's just say, when Natchez Burning came out, everybody remembers when True Detective broke, you know? That really heralded the opening of a new space that is now the most desired space in all television or movies. Because think about it. How many of you adults out there still go to the movie house to see a movie? What do we all do? We live to binge watch. And so when this deal first happened, there were multiple A-list actors interested, and I chose the way I chose. But certain things having to do with acting and actors, let's just say, held us up. Okay? And in that time, suddenly that space, everybody, every director from Ridley Scott to whoever came into that space, the top actors in the world, suddenly it's the most saturated space there is in the business. And so we're dealing now with those kind of odds, and it's tough.
You hear so many people say now that television has gotten so good and that the writing is so good.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you agree that some of the best writing is not necessarily between hardcovers, but is on your TV screen or on your iPad.
100%. Because publishing is generally driven by, you know, the beach book. Seriously. I mean, or the latest trend, okay? Girl on a Train hits. And so what do the publishers do? Like Lemmings, they run out and sign 400, the girl in the radio studio, the girl on her unicycle, the girl on whatever. That's how publishing works, right? Whereas TV, they're taking chances. The money that they spend in general, they can afford to throw some shows against the wall and do stuff really, really creative. Now, part of what gets somebody like me and makes it tough is that when this deal happened, we're talking about Game of Thrones-like budget, $50 million a year, $5 million an episode, and that gets serious when you talk that. Yeah. You can't just throw that against the wall and see what sticks. So, but is the best writing there? With few exceptions, absolutely. And I'm addicted, man, to certain series. You know, Vikings season 1 and 2. I mean, come on.
I can't wait to read about the dragons in Natchez. I think that's going to be really good.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
A Song of Fire and Ice. Yeah. On the bayou.
I'm starting to feel like George R.R. Martin, I'll tell you, with the weight of those books.
Well, at least you don't have four more to deliver, right? So you.
Right. But I tell you what, if I had brought in the large print edition of this book, I could have killed you with it.
No, this was the hernia was enough. So I survived the last week. In terms of what you're binge watching, you know, what writing is striking you right now?
Wow, you put me on the spot again. Vikings. I love a show called Ripper Street. I like Poldark. That's a guilty mm-hmm. pleasure. I tell you, here's the funniest thing. A lot of times people ask you what are you most ashamed to admit? A classic novel you didn't read or yeah. whatever? Let me tell you a show I haven't seen one episode of, and I'm saving it for next time I'm in the hospital coming out of a coma. And that is Breaking Bad. People think, are you kidding? You have never seen
it. It's in your blurb.
That's right. People come around and say, oh, you're William Faulkner for the Breaking Bad generation. And I pretend I know what that means. I mean, I sort of know the Walter yeah, White story.
Right.
Stuff, but literally, I'm saving it for next time I'm incapacitated. I'm doing every episode.
Well, there you go. So next time Greg Iles is in town, we'll quiz him about Breaking Bad. I want to thank you so much for joining us. He's going to be at the Barnes & Noble at Arboretum tonight at 7 o'clock. Greg Iles, thank you so much for joining us. The book is called Mississippi Blood, the trilogy. Is the Natchez trilogy, I should say. And I appreciate your time today. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks.